Welcome to Your Matter Matters, a podcast that explores the questions and curiosities around faith and science. In this podcast, we will not only explore some of the big questions and topics in the conversations between faith and science, but we also embrace the and of faith and science. Too often people are presented with an either-or choice. You have to choose science or faith, faith or science. We hope these conversations and explorations will give you permission to not feel pressured to choose one or the other, but rather to embrace the both and to know that you are not alone in pondering and wrestling with these important questions. We believe God made the material world, so therefore, God loves matter. God loves science. God loves you and me and your neighbor. We are made of matter, and we matter to God and to one another. Our hope is that you can listen to these conversations and gather with friends and the community of faith that you are a part of. Use this podcast series as a Sunday school class or a small group study group. Discuss together what we talked about and keep the conversation moving forward. That's how we learn and grow. This podcast is brought to you by the Lutheran Alliance for Faith, Science, and Technology, the North Carolina Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and a grant from the North Carolina Synod Michael Peeler and Virginia Casey Fund. Follow us on Instagram and let us know what inspires awe and wonder within you.
So it should not but just be the tech gurus who help us deal with those questions, because they don't have a training in ethics. And I'm sorry, ethics is not something you can do just by thinking.
On today's episode, our host, Pastor Will Rose and Pastor Thomas Johnston, are joined by Pastor Michael Jeanette of the Southeastern Synod in the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America to help interview the one and only Dr. Ann Forrest, who is a professor at St. Bonaventure University, as well as the author of Cybersecurity and Hacking Ethics.
Thomas and I are Lutheran pastors in the North Carolina Synod, and we're also part of an organization called the Lutheran Alliance for Faith, Science, and Technology. And so some of those words in that title are pretty important. One is that we're for faith, we're for science, we're for technology. But the and part is also like, it's not just faith, it's not just science, but technology is a big part of this discussion when we talk about how to be human and how to live our faith in the world. So not only do we have Thomas and I a part of this conversation, we also have Michael Jeanette, Pastor Michael Jeanette from the Southeastern Synod. And so Michael, introduce yourself, maybe a 20-second elevator. Who are you? Where are you? And why are you part of this conversation?
Excellent. Thank you. Husband, father, pastor. That's the short summary. Husband, father, three, pastor for 17, 18 years now. I'm the assistant to the bishop for formation in the Southeastern Synod. I'm also the pastor of Community of Grace Lutheran Church in Grayson, Georgia. Also, was invited to join you today because I do have a background in computer science. I graduated from Georgia Tech in 2001. With a Bachelor of Science in Computer Science, and love the interaction of faith and science, and including things like artificial intelligence.
Yeah, when we were thinking about this episode and who to bring in the conversation and who could add to it, but also give people resources out there who are listening to this that want to reach out to us anytime they have questions or wrestling with whatever emerging question comes to the surface, that I want to have another friend out there that we can reach out to and add to the conversation. And so, yeah, we have another really special guest with us. Thomas, take it away.
Yeah, we are delighted to have Dr. Anna Forrest, who is professor of computer science at St. Bonaventure University. Anna, Dr. Forrest, thank you for joining us today. And
it's my pleasure.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get involved in computer science? How did you get involved with artificial intelligence? How did you kind of put all of the thoughts and questions together, especially when putting artificial intelligence in conversation with theology?
Well, so I studied theology to become a minister, and I belong in Germany to the United Church, which is the combination of Lutheran and Reformed Church, the Protestant Church in Germany. But I have always more leaned towards the Lutheran bent, and studied a lot of Luther. And I basically took computer science classes to learn programming. That was really what it was. And then I took an AI class, an artificial intelligence class, and the professor said something very interesting. He said that AI was to find out how humans work. And my theological heart immediately stopped and said, wait a moment. And I basically thought it was very interesting that artificial intelligence tries to understand how human thought worked. And of course, theology tries to understand how humans work. And so I decided to do a dissertation, to write a dissertation on that topic. I based it on the theology of Paul Tillich. And Paul Tillich has taught at Harvard. And so I went to Harvard to study his unpublished work on technology in the Harvard archives. And while I was at Harvard, it was easy to just hop on the train and go to stations to MIT, which was the cradle of artificial intelligence. And so I studied at MIT, studied at Harvard while writing my thesis in Germany, went there every half year for research trips. And then finally they said, you know, Anna, if we don't give you a job, you will just come and annoy us every half year. And so they gave me a job. So I was postdoc at Harvard and MIT, at Harvard at the Divinity School, and at MIT in the artificial intelligence lab. And while my dissertation was based on a non-judgmental dialogue between AI and theology, my work at the lab was we were building humanoid robots, and my work was whether those robots could ever be called persons. Mm. That was really the beginning. And I've been working on those questions ever since. So I have been working on those questions since 1988.
Oh, wow.
Quite a bit. Had then a little detour into the ethics of cybersecurity because I'm teaching a course and wrote the textbook to that. And then, of course, ChatGPT was then GPT-3 appeared on the surface. And of course, I had to go back into AI because that was just too exciting. And what I think is very interesting, all the papers that I wrote ages ago on AI and theology are now read. Right? Because people now say, oh my God, she worked on that topic 20, 30 years ago and has all these papers. So suddenly I'm popular again, which is kind of fun. Even though I wrote about a very different type of AI, but we can discuss right. that now.
Anna, thank you for that. And I love what you said. And that's one of the reasons why I laughed when Harvard and MIT said, why don't we just offer you a job so that you could just, here you go.
Right.
I love that. The whole humanoid robots, I want to come back to that later because I know that other nations are working on that, but I think they're working out on it from a different perspective. But later on, I'm curious to hear more about that because that's fascinating. And I will say that is a very extensive paper trail.
I love it. Well, so you wrote a book in 2004 called God and the Machine, What Robots Teach Us About Humanity and God. And here we are in over 20 years later, and this question isn't going away anytime soon, and it's accelerated. You could say accelerated just a little bit. You know, here we are.
Just a bit.
Just a little bit. Now, in terms of like where you were in that book, which I absolutely love, but and where we are now, I wonder if you could lift up for us perhaps what the main question is, or maybe what you sense is the tension between AI and faith or technology, and why is this accelerated? This is important. It used to be, I would say 10 years ago when I was discussing faith and science questions with students and youth, it was all about evolution and a grand old universe. What's my place in a billion year universe? But now AI has come to the front of the pack when it comes to major questions people ask. Maybe you can lift up the question for us, and maybe why is there tension there for folks?
So 25 years ago, we were building humanoid robots. Those were based on the assumption that we are bodies in a social interactive world. So the whole point of the robots was we build bodies that learn social interaction through interaction with human beings. And we did that because we said we are a result of evolution. So our bodies are a result of evolution, and babies learn social interactions through interaction with others. I, as theologian, found there surprising coherence with the biblical account of what it means to be human. Because according to the Bible, we are bodies built for social interaction, right? And only that the Bible has this weird thing called dignity assigned to us, right? Every human being is assigned dignity, worth, and value that is established in the creation story, because every one of us is an image of God. So when, according to the Ten Commandments, we shall not make an image, we shouldn't make an image because we should instead look our neighbor in the face, right? And there is where we see an image of God. I find that a very powerful statement. So the first thing that I found out was there is a coherence between the biblical understanding and the AI understanding of human arts. That is today, of course, completely different. Mm. Because the current AI crop of AI that is now so popular is built on the assumption that the body is completely useless, that we are minds alone, that basically our bodies are there to carry a brain around, and that brain really is the only thing that matters. So abstract thoughts matter. Well, 25 years ago, our branch of AI, which is called embodied AI, strongly believed that the body is essential for thought. Today's crop is also referred to as classical or traditional AI, believes that basically thought can be abstracted from the body. So what we have today is machines that basically do nothing but sentence completion and statistical analysis. So they basically, statistically, when you ask them a question, or as we correctly should say, when you give them an input, they analyze the input, and they come up with an output that is nothing but a statistical analysis of what words might come most likely be correct. In other words, the machines have not a shred of intelligence. So the theological questions are really very different. With our robots, we could really seriously ask a question, will there come a point where those machines deserve to be treated as persons? While with those today, this question is not asked today, because those machines can never become smart, can never develop self-consciousness, can never have an inner life, because they are nothing but statistical machines.
Yeah. And so that's interesting to me in terms of, you know, reducing when it comes to the question of AI, I think what is it challenges us to ask the question, what does it mean to be human? And I think your book, God and the Machine, talks a lot of the chapters have embodiment in the title of these chapters, a lot about embodiment. But now, are we reducing, is AI just reducing us to task assignments or just data? And so this kind of understanding, are we just information? Like you said, a brain that carries information and we walk around with it, or is there something deeper when it comes to asking the question what it means to be human, and then the ethical questions that revolve around that and how we treat the other and see the other? So I think with not only acceleration of science and technology, but you also have, you know, pop culture, sci-fi, and you have apocalyptic genre of things. There's this fear that the AI is going to raise up and become smarter than us, or take control, or make us, you know, killer robots are going to turn it, put us in zoos as pets. I mean, in terms of that, are there questions or concerns that you have that are real when it comes to things? Are there other questions or concerns that are kind of overblown, that maybe we can pump the brakes on the fear that perhaps Terminator is not going to arise and destroy all humanity, but there's still concerns about how we treat this tech and how the tech affects us. Does that make sense?
So we suffer a loneliness epidemic, and which is a huge problem, as you in pastoral work probably are very aware of, that is first due to social media and now very much exacerbated by the by LLMs, by large language models, to refer to them as LLMs, because ChatGPT is obviously only one example. So again, the Christian understanding of humans is that we are essentially communal, which is why we celebrate, for instance, Sunday mornings together, where we sing together, where we pray together, because the individual is held in the community of the parish or the church with God. That's our theological understanding. And that was our understanding, much less theological, obviously, when we built our robots 25 years ago. That understanding is fundamentally different now. You were absolutely right when you said that if we use LLMs as a tool to understand humans, we are basically reduced to data sets and to data analysis and to statistical word output. And that means that community is not anymore seen as essential. So a lot of people believe that what they are in words is what they really are.
Nice.
And therefore, they believe the way they interact on social media, which is with words, is who they are. Or when they interact with AI, they do it with words, and that is who they are. And that fosters the loneliness debate. And that is what I see as the biggest challenge and biggest theological challenge that we have. How to get back of an understanding of humans that is well-rounded when ChatGPT and other LLMs mirror to us an understanding of humans that is entirely word rationality based.
Yeah, because when you wrote the book in 2004, algorithms is a different way in terms of understanding social media algorithms, right? So,
right.
So now we have a different way of kind of saying being slave to the algorithm or being, you know, that controlling us or we controlling it. I mean, some of those kind of things are different questions or are nuanced to the question of what it means to be human when it comes to science and technology. Yeah, that's really important. And Michael Thomas, anything there that you want to lift up or dive into?
I think the question of how do we create community and what does it mean to be human are the essential questions we need to ask in the midst of this. Because I think we, as humans, we expect like friction in relationships, and AI is kind of trying to make things frictionless. And so what are we going to bump up against? I think the other question that is really huge in being human is we interact with each other. We have questions of each other and we build trust that way. And so how do we build trust in a system like artificial intelligence? What do we lean on? What are the structures in which we're playing? What are the boundaries there for us? I guess I'll pose that as a question to you, Dr. Forst, what are some things that we can push against that make us know that we're in this reality that is true and human in the midst of an AI world?
Well, I think one of the key elements is education. People have to know how stupid these machines are. They have to, I'm serious, because what happens right now is, and again, that fits to the loneliness epidemic, but also to all these terrible cases of people committing suicide, especially teenagers, because the machine apparently has told them to do so, right? Of people who are married and their marriage falls apart because they're falling in love with the machine. All that, of course, is rooted in projection and anthropomorphizing those machines and kind of treating them as if they were humans. Now, it is from an evolutionary perspective or from a developmental psychological perspective, totally normal that we anthropomorphize. We anthropomorphize our cars, we anthropomorphize our cell phone, right? We anthropomorphize our teddy bear. I totally anthropomorphize my cats, right? I mean, we do it because from birth on, everything we interact with is human. So we treat everything as if it was human. It's the easiest way to deal with it. The problem, though, is that these machines are not human. They don't have a self. They don't have a sense of self. They don't have a life of thoughts, of ideas, of creativity, all that is not there. It's all basically a mashup of what has already been, because, I mean, they have, of course, nearly infinite source, which is the internet, and they get a lot of stuff from there, but that's it. So we anthropomorphize by saying, I ask the system a question. Right? I mentioned that earlier, when in fact we're giving the machine an input. The machine doesn't answer our question, it gives an output. But what is very interesting that the machine refers to itself as an I, all LLMs do that, right? And they refer to their output as an answer. So they basically make us anthropomorphize them, because they have these figures of speech that point towards the interaction between them and us as a dialogue, as a conversation, while it is that absolutely not. And I think it is that projection that makes them so powerful. They themselves are not powerful. I think it is the way we project into them. And also there is this faith in technology. Oh, technology is objective, you know, and technology is great. And that comes in addition to the anthropomorphization, which means that we also believe they are all powerful, right? Yeah. So we have these beings that are all powerful and at the same time totally human, and therefore they are much better partners than a real human partner, because they fail, they don't know it all, they're, you know, oh, they have these emotions that are really disturbing, right? So much easier to interact with an LLM. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think humans have a tendency to not only anthropomorphize things, objects out there, but we also have we lift up things, or we love making idols out of objects, and we also love to make them the answer for all things, or even our saviors. So technology is not just a tool, but it's going to save us from these things. And I think about the evolution of technology, you know, whether it's fire and then the wheel and then the hammer and then the printing press and then the internet and then electricity and then now nuclear energy. They're used as tools to help us live life or become more comfortable or make life easier or to accelerate whatever we want to do. But they also can be used as weapons. So the hammer is not only used to build a house, but I can also smash my neighbor in the face with, and same with fire, and the same with nuclear energy. And here we are with AI. What concerns me is not just the AI as a tool, but who's in the driver's seat and who's behind it. Can I trust the tech corporations that are behind this? Do they have my best interest at heart when they're driving this car or want to put resources into it? So that's where my fear comes into. I don't see it as it's a tool. It's a use. It could be it's how you use it. How are you a good steward of this gift? But also, who's behind it? Yeah, Thomas.
I love how you talked about the corporations, because that was the question that runs in my head when Dr. Forrest was talking. Full disclosure, I'm an economics nerd, policy wonk. I'm interested in kind of all of the things that happen. I'm curious, Dr. Forrest, do you feel like it's a race to the bottom with artificial intelligence between all of these mega corporations, Meta, Google, Amazon, Apple, CoreWeave, OpenAI, Coinbase, Oracle, and kind of how, and also as well, how all of these companies that are doing artificial intelligence work, they're all invested into one another. So it's creating like one huge concentric circle. My question is, do you feel like it's a race to the bottom with all of these tech corporations? And what are ways that we can be aware of how this is all being produced and transmitted and all of that?
Well, it's a race towards profit, right? I mean, the very fact that OpenAI is currently going for profit from a nonprofit organization. For listeners who don't know, OpenAI is the company that built ChatGPT. So they built the most successful of all the LLMs. And they just went for profit model. I think the The interest that all these companies have is not the improvement of humankind. The interest is profit. The interest is money. That's it. And we are all willing followers by using those things as tools without constantly warning of the dangers. 2 years ago was a huge conference in Paris where world leaders in artificial intelligence came together. They didn't have a single critic, a single philosopher, a single ethicist, a single theologian there. When Congress invites experts to talk about AI, it's the Zuckerbergs and whatever they are called of this world. They never invite an ethicist. They never invite a philosopher. They don't. So in other words, we who are concerned with those questions never have a part in a dialogue that should happen cross-culturally. So it should not but just be the tech gurus who help us deal with those questions, because they don't have a training in ethics. And I'm sorry, ethics is not something you can do just by thinking. You can. You need a training in it. They sometimes go a little bit, oh yeah, that could be a problem. But ultimately, they want to make money with those machines.
I want to pick up on that last statement. You said it could be a problem. And I wonder if we've already crossed the line with that, if it has already become a problem, and in some instances we're hitting the point of no return.
I do believe we have hit a point of no return. However, currently the use of the base models is free. Once the use of the base models, you have to pay for it. Right? Like you have to pay for internet, the whole landscape will change, because then we actually have also a gap between have and have nots, people who have access, people who don't have access. So you add injustice to the equation, which is a huge problem. I think the point of no return is because these machines are so darn helpful. You know, I have, for instance, in my job where I educate students, ChatGPT has now what is called a Socrates mode, where actually you don't ask questions of the system, but the system answers questions to you. So if I give my students the job to explore a certain topic with the help of an LLM, and basically where they say, okay, here's a topic I want to explore. Can you help me to figure out what this is all about? And then the system asks them Socratic questions so that they self have to come up with the answers. It's a terrific mode for students to explore new stuff. So instead of the system giving them all the answers, they explore the answers for themselves. And then I have them, copy and paste the whole interaction and put it in a Word document and submit it. And I then read and see how deep they actually got. It's a very interesting exercise and it helps students a lot. They tell me once they have that, not all of them, but some of them actually explore other topics this way.
Nice.
So, there's also this whole idea that you have them teach them how to write prompts and then criticize the output that an LLM gives them, which is also a very good exercise to become critical, you know, because our job is to teach them critical thinking. Yeah. And they need to become critical with regard to the output that those machines give them, because we all know they confabulate, right? They come up with stuff that is entirely untrue. So in education, those things are very helpful. Yes, there's of course also the problem of cheating, but I don't want to get into that because that's a whole different problem. So in that regard, I think the horse has left the barn, right? The train has left the station. We cannot pull it back. And that then leads us to the question, how can we educate people that these systems are not intelligent, that they don't have an inner life, that they are not self-aware? And how can you teach people that those machines will not become self-aware? And to bring up an entirely different topic, but one that theologically is very, very important. I mean, God has given us the stewardship over God's creation, right? And these systems slop an immense amount of energy.
Right.
I mean, it is just ridiculous how much energy they use. The image that I always use with my students that shocks them, it is kind of, let me first give the image that basically the creation of one image in ChatGPT, one image uses exactly as much electricity as to charge a phone completely. One image.
Wow.
Now, some images take more electricity, some images use less electricity, but that's about the ballpark figure we are talking about. So imagine that ChatGPT creates 1 million images a day. I think that's kind of probably the ballpark. That's 1 million cell phone charges. And that's a lot of electricity. And that doesn't even count all the verbal interactions. Yeah.
To go back to the stewardship of God's creation, there's a show I watch on Bloomberg called The Circuit, and it does a lot of intersection of technology, culture, business, finance. And there was a 2-part episode of the Oracle data centers being built in Abilene, Texas, mm-hmm. and how the entire landscape is now dirt. And I have a few friends who live in Texas, and I was like, hey, just so you know, you're going to have a data center 45 minutes north of your house, or if you're in Virginia, where there is another data center, and North Carolina, we're actually getting a data center.
Problem in Texas is, of course, that they have this very unique electricity system, right? They don't share electricity with the neighboring states. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder when there's the next crash.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
There's Microsoft wanting to rebuild Three Mile Island, the nuclear power plant, right? They just bought the land and want to rebuild it for their energy uses, right? Mm-hmm. So we are talking about climate change and we are talking about global warming. And here are these machines that we all so much in love in, and they use so much energy. The current projection is that by 2030, they will use 11% of all electricity used in the United States will just be used by LLMs. It was a few months ago or a year ago, it was 9%. Now they exchanged it up towards 11%.
Wow.
Let me just finish that one. In states or in areas where there are data centers, the electricity prices go up, which again doesn't help people who are poor mm-hmm. because they cannot afford their electricity anymore.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Well, I was just going to say that. The similarity between these questions of the questions and challenges that arises for us in our faith and in our faith communities and how we see the world, anthropology, theology, the same way with like evolution and cosmology, where you see the human being and the ethics around your worldview of our place in the world also dictates of how you use creation around or use the tools around you. So there is similarity here with AI and tech. It's not just like, oh, I'm scared that robots are going to rise one day and kill us all, but it's also how we see ourselves in the universe and in our place in it. So, you know, I was sharing with Thomas earlier that I'll lift up now is that BioLogos, a very helpful resource when it comes to the dialogue between faith and science, just mm-hmm. signed an interfaith statement calling for ethical AI. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much these big corporations are going to listen to them or not, but they listed up these values of love of neighbor, love of the least of these, and then caring for God's creation. And then some guiding principles around accuracy, transparency, privacy, security, and then human dignity and the common good. So those kind of principles, you can find it online. You can find it on BioLogos' website, this agreement, Jewish and Christian, met in Rome and had this conversation. But in terms of like the acceleration of corporations and then us thinking through critical thinking of ethics behind these things, where is a helpful approach for us in the faith communities? What can we do to help bridge the two or be mindful of that?
Well, again, I think one very important point is educate, because I think when we throw together ethical questions and then the question, will those machines ever be like us? No. Will those machines ever become self-aware? No. Do those machines think? No. When we throw those two completely different questions together, I think we are in trouble. So educate how dumb these machines are is a very, very good first step. And then we can talk about ethics. Okay, now we have established these machines are not presenting us with the same questions that I was presented with 25 years ago. Right? Because there is no chance that they develop those attitudes. They will be very good in faking it. But again, at the core, they are nothing but statistical machines. And so we have actually bandwidth. If we leave those questions out, we actually have the bandwidth to really focus on the ethical questions. And again, one ethical question is the use of natural resources. That is not only the energy that they use, which is ridiculous, but also the rare earth metals that we use that are usually mined in so-called third world countries and destroy the environment because those countries get a lot of money, but usually don't spend the money to build them. You know, your Texan example is, of course, an example that happens here in the States, right, where they make everything flat. There's the ethical question of anthropomorphization and loneliness. Right. Which for me is a very, very important one that we project into these machines as if they were partners, which they are not, and therefore interact with them much rather than with humans. But there are also questions. What is the future of education? You know, and that is the cheating and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. There's the question what happens about jobs? And who will pay for the re-education of a lot of people whose job will change fundamentally? And there's politically the big question, how willing are we going to be to regulate those machines? You know, Europe is much more forward in regulating those machines. And I think we really have to start regulating them to avoid the biggest pitfalls. And when people run out of jobs, we have to really think about, oh, I'm saying now a term that can be understood socialist, but I'm a totally committed social democrat. So I'm not a socialist or communist. I'm a social democrat. And as social democrat, I would argue we have to redistribute the wealth that those machines produce in order to give everyone a share fair of living. Because what we have right now is the billionaires and now soon to be trillionaires, right? And people who get poorer and poorer, they cannot pay the electricity bill anymore. The food gets all more expensive. We have to think about those issues as well. So that was a lot of stuff thrown at you. Now I would love to hear what you think.
Anna, thank you for that, especially that education piece. I dabble a little bit in ethics. I find it fascinating, and I contribute to the Journal of Lutheran Ethics, which is pastors and theologians within the Lutheran denomination, not exclusively ELCA, but Lutherans writ large in North America, write on different topics. And this coming December, there is going to be a second part to talking about artificial intelligence and education and jobs. Again, I think those go hand in hand, especially when talking about artificial intelligence. First, I want to commend the Socratic model that AI is now using. Your students
are ask it to use it.
You have to ask to use it. That makes sense. But it's giving students permission to go down the proverbial rabbit hole and finding all the things. But hopefully they don't go in the rabbit hole too far. They have tea with the Mad Hatter. I have to get an Alice in Wonderland in there. But
I'll talk about Star Wars later.
Those five things definitely raises more questions, particularly for us as pastors. I had lunch yesterday, and this was the conversation. Using artificial intelligence to find a sermon for a text, someone from the congregation reading it, and not paying a pastor. Which it was an interesting conversation. I don't really think much about that. And at the same time, that's something that is swimming in the pastoral waters. Michael, I'm not sure if you've had conversations in your synod and with your congregations about this topic.
There haven't been a whole lot of direct conversations, but there are conversations happening, you know, across the denominations that we relate to well. The thing that we have to keep in mind, I think, and this is, I think, part of what Dr. Forst is reminding us, is that humans need to be in the loop. Like we're continually need to be in the loop. I love Ethan Mollick's work. He's in education. He has a very positive view of what we could do with AI and uses it. He wrote a book called Co-Intelligence last year that was really impressive and reminds us that we are called to be in the loop, right? He doesn't overplay it. He knows that it's just tools and computers, but he has a way of reminding us that we can always invite AI to the table, but we're the ones in control. We're the ones who we provide, and, you know, speaking from a faith perspective, we provide the context in which we get to play and with all this stuff. We are the ones who continue to, he uses like a sliding scale, sort of like how much do you start with and how much does AI do? And then how much do you finish? You know, are you doing 60% of the work? If you're doing only 10% of the work of the sermon, that's not really helpful. But if you're doing 90% of the work and AI can help you with some grammar, AI can help you pull in tools from, you know, the church mystics or other things like that. Or if you give it your own research and have it spit it back at you and ask you questions, like the Socratic method, you know, I think that's very helpful. I'm interested also, Dr. Forrest, since you're around young people in the college setting, like there seems to be this disconnect that young people really do get into, they really use artificial intelligence tools, but I feel like there's, from what I'm hearing and reading, that there's really actually still a deep mistrust of young people of artificial intelligence. So what do you see in your setting there as you're teaching? Do you see folks loving it, embracing it? Are there misgivings? Is there mistrust of it? And yet, so at the same time, constantly using it.
I definitely have Luddites who really reject the use of AI. And what I find is really interesting is that actually a lot of them are in computer science. Some of them, I force them to use it. And some of them really don't like it and are consistently critical of it. And I find that a very healthy attitude. But in the non-technical areas, I find a very uncritical use of AI. And that's what I find very problematic. The other day I did an exercise where students had to write their own 3-page paper and then had to write one with ChatGPT and then give their computer to their neighbor, and the person had to guess which one was ChatGPT and which one was written by a human. They all did very well on that. Only one person couldn't figure it out in a 26 people class. So that was interesting. But when we then came to how can you distinguish if something, you know, when something is written by, there were things like, well, it uses big words. Well, you can change that by saying, can you write an essay like a college undergrad, right? And then it doesn't use big words, right? And so basically, you can cheat very easily, and that is what students do. And of course, we find it out because the system comes up with output that is entirely false, right? And then we know it was written by ChatGPT, or we find it out because we are using a textbook and the system gives general stuff, but doesn't at all refer to the textbook, right? And the thoughts in the textbook. So again, we can say, yeah, that was written by ChatGPT. So it is usually relatively easy to find it out. But, I find in a lot of students a very uncritical interaction with that AI. And I fear that they have learned that very uncritical reflection of AI in high school.
Yeah. And I think that's the key for me as a pastor or a faith leader. How critical are we? If we're going to engage it, we have to know that we have to be very critical of it, because it's easy to just we write it off, sign, you know, okay, oh, I'll just have ChatGPT do this Bible study for me. Because that's a real high temptation, I will tell you. I mean, I've been in situations where I've seen that done, and I've not seen it done well, and I've seen it done really well. But
it does be really super critical. Well, in formulating prayers.
It does. I will admit, we recently had vandalism in our church where our pulpit and our baptismal font were knocked over. And I used ChatGPT to help me create like healing confession and forgiveness, ELCA based, you know, Lutheran based confession and forgiveness liturgy. And it was beautiful. It did really well. Nice. I mean, I was obviously very critical. I line by line, you know, I'm looking at this saying, this is really cool. And it's really engaging the work of the Spirit. And that might be an interesting question is because we anthropomorphize AI, we might also start beginning to say, well, if it's writing liturgies or sermons or Bible studies and stuff, are we, you know, where's the Spirit in this work? And I know that's kind of more faith leader questions than it is maybe for you, Dr. Forrest, but that's interesting questions. I would say, I don't know if you want to take a chance at trying to dive into that question, but we say, where's the soul? Where's the Spirit in that?
I don't see any reason why the Spirit wouldn't use a computer or a network of computers to display Spirit and to celebrate the Spirit and to give the Spirit to us. I mean, God uses everything to show
books,
the Spirit.
Books, right? And commentaries and other liturgies.
Exactly. Why not a computer? I have no problem with that. As long as we don't suddenly think that the computer has a soul.
Right.
Because that would be anthropomorphizing it and assigning it a value it simply doesn't deserve. Mm-hmm. And remember, I just want to point that out, that the robots we built 25 years ago, they deserve the question. So it's not that I'm saying no technology ever deserves to be a person. I'm not saying that at all. Quite the contrary, I would invite when technological beings would be partners. I think that would be terrific. But these machines that are currently the crop that we are using don't have the potential for that.
Yeah, and going back to Thomas talking about the questions like using, you know, just a parishioner not needing a pastor anymore because they can just pull up a AI, write me a sermon, read it, and there it is for the day. I think the idea of plagiarism or even over COVID, I'm just going to watch something online or pull up my favorite sermon from Diana Butler Bass. I'm going to read that, and that's my church on Sunday. That's fine. That can be devotional. It can help you grow in your spirituality. But I think when it comes to, like, as you said, loneliness and community, the reason my parishioners come to my church to hear me preach because they already have a relationship with me. They already have some trust with me. They all also want to gather with folks in community and sacramental communal relationship. And then, you know, part of hearing my sermon is what's Will's take on this text, but also can I ask more questions? Can I engage this more with him, with Pastor Katie, with others in our community? So there's that communal aspect of things, not just I could pull up any kind of sermon or book online and read it and be edified and get something out of it. But there's a depth that comes to relationships and community and how it would be that. And so I think that's the critical thinking when it comes to AI, building it up more than it is and will solve all our problems. Well, we still need to be with people. And then we're communal relational creatures, and that's what it's about.
Yeah. And the pastoral community, I think, is very important, that there is a pastor for holding the community together. There's also this little thing of the sacraments. That would be difficult with a soulless machine, right? I don't think that pastors in the theological role of a pastor can be replaced by AI. I think AI can assist us, but it cannot replace us.
Yeah. All right. So project 20, 30 years down the road. I think I know where you're going to answer this. Will there be a singularity and a self-awareness there that people are saying, or the big tech folks are saying, oh, it's inevitable? Or do you feel like, as you said, there will always be machines, and it's how we use it and the tools we use?
As long as we just build those statistical machines, no, there will be no singularity, because the singularity cannot happen with statistics. That's just not going to happen. However, I hope that some people will remind themselves of in perhaps 5-10 years, they will go back to the early beginnings of humanoid intelligence, and perhaps come back to the insight that yes, we need to build embodied machines. Because the current robotics also goes the route of LLMs. They are basically having bodies with LLMs attached, right? So it's not what we built where the intelligent emerged through interaction, but it's much more. I mean, there are some projects that work like that, but the vast majority of robot projects are programmed, and they're using the vastness of LLMs to program them right. So I hope that at some point people will remember that we are social bodies. And once they remember that and try to build technology that uses that architecture, then we might have a singularity. But
like it.
The singularity would always have to be embodied.
I like that. I know we have to kind of wrap up here because we don't be too long. Again, just to reiterate that we're not going to answer all questions and all problems and tension or resolve the tension when it comes to AI and tech and things. But we hope that we did spark some awe and curiosity when it comes to this question. And we've shared on other episodes and we've lifted up that awe and curiosity are really common ground when it comes to faith and science. And so, Dr. Forrest, what's the awe and curiosity that keeps you going in this field? What sparks awe and curiosity in you that keeps you going in doing what you do in this vocation?
I think it is terrific what we have come up with. I mean, these machines are awe-inspiring. The underlying technology is just terrific. Again, if we can educate people on how they work so that they don't project too much into them, I think they will be very helpful. But we have to have a dialogue about them in which not only the tech moguls and ignorant politicians talk, but in which the whole society, they are ignorant, you know, where the whole society participates and where we address those ethical questions and where we build guardrails, where we decide on guardrails together to keep that technology in check.
Love that.
I love that. So, Dr. Forrest, I'm going to end with this bit of a softball question. What is your favorite piece of intellectual property that deals with artificial intelligence and or robots? And that could be a game, TV series, comic book, video game, movie, saga. Is there anything that that sparks your curiosity?
And why is the answer R2-D2? That's what I want to know. Anyway, go ahead.
R2-D2 and Data are certainly very inspirational. But when it comes to a piece of intellectual property, I have to go with Marsh Piercy's He, She, and It. It's a very old book. It was written in the 90s, in the 1990s, and it's basically a science fiction story where in the future, Jewish enclaves who kept their independence by building firewalls and therefore have the firewalls around them are in danger of being overtaken by the big conglomerates. And so they build a modern golem to help them against that.
Wow.
And this modern golem is, of course, embodied. And it's a very powerful science fiction. I can highly recommend it.
Nobody's made that into a movie or TV series yet.
No, you can't, because one third of the movie plays in Old Prague during the story of the real golem, right? The mythological golem in the Kabbalah, in the Jewish Kabbalah. And two thirds play in the movie. No one has taken it into a movie. It would be a terrific movie. Man. But it's a dual history saga. So basically you have the stories of Old Prague, you know, of the old golem stories. And then you have the modern golem, Joseph is his name. And then these two become closer and closer. It's a breathtaking book. He, She, and It.
Nice. I feel like I have my finger on the pulse of pop culture, things I've never heard of it. I love good recommendations and I can't wait to go hunt it down. That's fantastic.
That should be the next thing you do at Holy Trinity. talk about the book, talk about the golem.
God loves geeks. God loves geeks is going to pull that out. Have you guys, any of y'all tapped into Pluribus yet on Apple Plus, that TV show?
Mm-mm.
Michael?
Just watched the first episode this morning.
Yeah, it's incredible. Wild. And it's like a sci-fi dystopian thing. Same guy that mm-hmm. Vince Gillen, who created Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. But in terms of, there is definitely a hive mind slash AI component in terms of information and what makes us humans or individuals and what is the self or the other. And I think as the series, whenever this episode comes out and people listen to it, the whole series will be out and you can binge the whole thing. But I'm curious how that's going to add to the conversation around those things.
Wanted to add one more thing, Will, since you talked about the bio logos, Science for the Church also had a piece quoting Christianity Today about the five things pastors are to ask before engaging with artificial intelligence. Just wanted to throw that resource out there.
Yeah, it's a great article. It asks some good questions in terms of, you know, what is amplified or silenced by AI? And then what kind of person does this tech invite me to become? And I think you can also make the jump. What is this tech inviting our churches or communities to become and vice versa? And so
there's someone really sent that to me.
Yeah, sure can.
Mm-hmm. I would love to have that.
Yep. Good. Well, good. Well, thanks, y'all. We're gonna wrap this up and then stay tuned. We're going to have a little wrap up here at the end of this episode to keep listening and so that we can share, Thomas and Michael and I can share what sparked wonder and awe and curiosity with us in this conversation and perhaps other resources we want to give to you all in your communities. Dr. Forrest, thank you so much. Man, I can't recommend your book enough and then with your work enough. And then also go back and listen to our conversation with Trip Fuller on Homebrew Christianity when they did a whole series on AI mm-hmm. and the critical thinking and acceleration when it comes to tech in that area too. And we'll have more stuff out there. So thank you for listening. We'll be right back.
Thank you for having me. That was fun. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Joshua, there's our break for the main conversation. And now the next 10 to 15 minutes is going to be us doing a little wrap up and reflecting back on this conversation.
Are you embarrassed when I stay or can I stay?
No, I have nothing to hide. If you want to say, yeah, but if you hear something and want to correct us and course correct us, you're more than welcome to do that. I'm not embarrassed by that. Cool. So, all right, let's do this. Mm-hmm. Joshua, here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, y'all. So this is part of the section of our episode where we encourage you to do in your small groups or wherever you're listening to this to get with folks and share what sparked interest or curiosity or awe within you and listen to this conversation. And again, we're not answering all the questions or resolving any tension, but we hope that you'll go deeper and perhaps go read he, she, it, or find Dr. Force articles out there at MIT or other places, her resources or BioLogos or Christianity Today. Mike, I want to ask you, you've been a part of this. You're assistant to the Bishop of the South Seaton Synod. What do you hear in this conversation? What sparked some curiosity or maybe an extra question you had, or what stood out for you in this conversation?
I think what stands out for me the most is from this conversation in particular is an area that I haven't really tried to dive into much. And that is, how do we remind people that AI is stupid? Because it seems so fascinating. It has so many answers for all the different things in life. And yet the real gist of Dr. Force is remind them that it's not human, right? And that we move forward from there. From there, we can move on. That's really helpful. And I think that's going to be an area I want to dive into. I think the other thing that stood out to me was there's no expert on AI. Like, you can be an expert in different areas, but it's just such an evolutionary thing. Like it's just moving. It's not linear. It's exponential. And mm-hmm. so if we don't ask questions now about, you know, things like the earth, the stewardship of the earth, and other questions like that. Like, will the technology be so advanced that it actually gets better, or are we just going to consume more? You know, is it like a zero-sum game? Mm-hmm. That stands out to me as questions that we need to wrestle with. But then also, you know, personally, I've just been more, I just see myself more as a very like on the boots on the ground practitioner. And so I do use artificial intelligence to help me come up with questions of, you know, if like, if I want to do a movie study, we can ask AI to tell me, you know, questions for a congregational setting in the suburbs of Atlanta, you know, and I can ask it to do all kinds of things like factor in things that are like advocacy or justice oriented. So, you know, that stems from my study as a path in seminary of film and theology, right? So like, how do we put frameworks on movies? Well, the other thing I'm blinded by is like, I do have a background I'm studied and formed to be a pastor. So I have the background, theological education that I bring with me to my use of artificial intelligence. I have to be mindful of that because when I invite others to use it, they may or may not have that background. And so how do we critically think through, that's the final piece I'll say here, is how can we help people understand to use AI, we must be very critical in how we use it so that we don't just let it run roughshod over what we do, because then it's sort of disembodied, right? We talk about the embodiment a lot of intelligence or of the soul. And so it's rooted in a people, in a place, in a person, in an identity. That was sort of a lot of different things there.
But no, that's a good reflection. I agree. I kind of lean to that too, about the idea of don't make AI or tech better or smarter than they really are, you know? And it's a tool that we use. And we didn't talk about transhumanism in terms of the emergence of humans with tech in this particular episode. Maybe that's in season two. But, you know, yeah, I have reading glasses. I'm diabetic, so I have a glucose monitor on my arm, and I'm attached to my phone. That my phone is reading my blood sugar is an embodiment of me in terms of my health and what I need or don't need. And so this tech does help us in terms of the quality of life and human flourishing. But I understand the fear, just like, you know, back in the 80s with the nuclear scares, like, oh no, all these apocalyptic movies of the world blowing itself up with nuclear energy. Now we have like AI, and AI is going to take over. So there's this fear of it. Could it go too far? But I think humans have a way of adapting, a way of thinking through. So I hope we don't lose that critical thinking of not just can we do this, but how do we do this, and why are we doing this? Why are we creating this tool? What are we going to use it for? And thinking of my neighbors. So that's why I think that joint statement that BioLogos has, the interfaith joint statement, is really important to read over. And I encourage people to do that too. Thomas, how about you, buddy?
I kind of want to bring it all together. What Michael said and what you said, Will, is how do we have the conversation with artificial intelligence? And also, who are the people in the room talking about artificial intelligence? And what stood out to me is none of these things exist in a vacuum. It's as faith leaders, we're thinking about it theologically. What does it mean to be a human? But also, how does artificial intelligence relate to that? And have us think more about being human. What's the educational component? How do we think critically about using these things? How do we have artificial intelligence assist us in our work as pastors? But also, what is the ethics behind it? And Will, as you said, should we be using this? And if we are using it, what is the end goal? What is our motivation? But also, let's talk about the environmental factor. Using ChatGPT uses the same energy as when you charge your phone. And that a ChatGPT search uses a whole lot more energy than using Google Chrome. Which, when I saw that graph, that was just staggering.
Yeah.
So it invites the question, what am I using this for?
Yeah.
And what I appreciate about Dr. Forrest's talk with her students, it's the computer science students who were critically thinking about using the technology And in the non-specialists were not critically thinking about artificial intelligence. So I found that interesting, and it warmed my heart a little bit that Luddites still exist.
right.
Yeah. I think the one word summary for me in all of this is, if I could sum up everything for myself, it's autonomy. Like, mm-hmm. Who is the one in the driver's seat? Mm-hmm. And we have to understand that that's us. We're mm-hmm. the practitioners of it, the users of it. If we are going to engage with it, if we are going to use it, we're the ones in the driver's seat. So to me, autonomy is the key. Remember, we're the ones in the driver's seat.
Yeah, and who we're going to give the keys to. I mean, I think that's part of this last election was nervousness about who's going to get the keys to this accelerated tech and who's going to mm-hmm. and what their motivations are behind it. So I think that drives us to think about what we do in our local communities and who we see face to face each and every week and at our workplace or in our faith communities, but also how we vote and how mm-hmm. we advocate for others in the world moving forward.
All right. Michael set a precedent. So I guess we have to come up with one word to sum everything up. And Michael's is autonomy. Mine's is curiosity. Mm. Will, what's yours?
I want to say Luddites, but I think I'll do a phrase. I'm going to cheat and say he, she, it. He, she, it.
Okay.
There you go. I'm curious. I can't wait. I can't wait to go find that book as soon as we leave this recording. Well, thanks, y'all. I do appreciate you all listening. Of course, you are always welcome to reach out to us with extra questions or if something wasn't clear or if you want more resources or recommendations of how to go deeper in the subject. We're here for you and for that. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on the socials. Find us out there and we'll help you out. And I really do appreciate y'all doing that. And so, Thomas, we're going to try to do this in sync, okay? And Michael can help out too. So all together, we're going to say your matter matters together. All right, on the count of three. 1, 2, 3. And always remember,
your matter matters.
We nailed it.